Hello, thank you, and welcome to Diversity at Work Reimagined. My name is Jim Woods. I'll be your host today, and we have a special guest. His name is Carl Watkins. Did I say that correct, Carl?
Yes, Carl Shine.
Carl Sean. And Carl is a fantastic guest, and I read his biography. I have stalked him without his not even knowing about it, all right, to know everything about the guy. And I am so interested about this man and his insights that help our human resource experts that we have here. We deal with businesses, the business people, and give them insights to recognize that diversity isn't just about gender or race. It's about the entire person, their well-being, their self-efficacy, their personal development, all of it. And Carl is someone that has a magnificent story that can help us in a way. Thank you and welcome, Carl.
Thanks so much, Jim. I appreciate you having me on. Welcome to your listeners as well. It's an honor to be able to not only share your story, but to know that you have someone stalking you, right? In that frame of reference, I take that to all glory be to God for what He has done in my life and through my life, and what He has what He's going to continue to do. So I look forward to this interview.
Well, I think it's really great. Now, I was going to our guest, I was going to ask Carl about some of his struggles and the things that made him into the person he is today. But he told me earlier that his life has been a piece of cake, that he wished he could have had. He said he wished he could have been like an ordinary, he said he wished he could be like an ordinary person that has life tough, but it was extreme. He's one of those superheroes that are rare. No, Carl, please tell us about some of the things you had to go through that made you up to who you are today.
Yes, it started, I guess, and to go to it on a fast track of saying. I was born and raised in Chicago, the south side of the city, Englewood District, if we go even further, one of the most most notorious districts to grow up in, and one of the most dangerous districts in the Chicago area. And I lived a hood life, and it's just about the best way to put it. But I always had an inspiration to be more than my neighborhood. And in that, I just didn't know how it would come about. I had a lot of friends that perished, drained, gangs, drug dealing, just fell off the wagon with a whole lot of things. And the inspiration to do more was just seeing my environment and not seeing anyone come out of there unless they were playing sports, or unless went away to college and somehow never came back. And I just knew that it was more to offer, not only from that area, but from me as an individual. And my life was tough. I was, and I share this, I share this as part of a growing, because I know it touches people and people can relate. I was molested as a child, and that molestation turned to alcoholism, that alcoholism turned to depression, and that depression turns with a couple of attempted suicides. And through that, I get this great relationship with God. It came through that. I didn't cry a lot about not having, not wanting, not knowing why me. I never took on that attitude. And it's now that I know that I didn't take it on because God had me to prepare me to be able to share what others was going through. And I had no one to talk to, and I had no one to say this to. It was a family member, so of course I couldn't tell of that. But what it did, it gave me some things on the other side that propelled me to the person I am today.
How did you have this epiphany, this wake up moment to say, this life that I have had all my life is not good enough for me?
I went to the military. I was a very high, I guess a lot of that was the effects of the molestation and the ability to go elsewhere. I became a very avid reader. I read everything. Became an avid writer, and I read the dictionary. I got it as a Christmas gift as a kid. So I became very articulate, and I learned how to write things that I couldn't say verbally. And so I excelled in school, and everybody just thought, oh, this is a great student. I was an athlete, everything, but they didn't know the inner pain. And I joined the military because I wasn't ready for college. I was still doing drinking, and I was still, and I said, I didn't want to waste that. I knew of friends that had done that and came back home, and they was considered failures. And I said, what can I do? And an army sergeant came up to, I had a big assembly at the school, and he talked about the armed forces. And I said, well, this is maybe an opportunity for me to go, maybe get my head on straight, come back, and they were talking about paying for college. And I said, oh, this is great because my parents don't have that anyway. And I went to the military. I signed in at 17. I graduated from high school at 17. And my mom had to sign for me. So she signed for me to go away. And on there, I excelled as well in the military, but I still was this drunkard going out to work. Because a lot of people don't understand, once you get through training, the military is just like a job. You go to work and you get off and all of that. You go to parties, all that kind of thing. And that's all I did. And we had a, I was a tank commander, and we had exercises that we would do. I was a 19-year-old in Germany. And we went out to the field, the forest, and we did live fire exercise. And one night, the pain was just overwhelming. And what I was feeling and not being able to talk and not being able to share. And I just sat on the end of the tank, and we was issued a 45 as our arms gun. And I said, at that point in time, I just created this epiphany of how I'm going to end my life, how my parents will get the money because I'm out here live fire. I put all this together as a 19-year-old in my mind, right? Had no idea how it would play out, but I created this scenario where I would go out here and kill myself. The Army would definitely buy in and cover it up, say he died out there. I just had it all, right? And I pulled a gun and I pulled a trigger. I pulled it three times, Jim, and it didn't fire. And it didn't fire. And the epiphany, if you want to call it, I call it my Moses Ten Commandments moment. The moon, it was pitch black in there. Now, mind you, in a forest where you can't see in the front of your face. We're out in Germany, it's cold, we're sleeping on tanks. And it's pitch black out there, except for our lights and our tanks and the carousels we were carrying. And the moon shined just about as bright as the sun out there. And I screamed to the top of my lung. Mind you, we're all sleeping on tanks here. Everybody's out here. I got a whole battalion out here. So any noise is made, we should be able to hear. No one heard me screaming. No one woke up. And no one, and I didn't get any voice. I didn't get any rumbling. I just felt an embrace in spirit that just caused me to just overwhelmingly cry. And I could not hold back the tears. I mean, I cried and screamed and hollered. And I said, oh, I can't even kill myself right. This is what I was screaming. But no one heard this. And I just felt this hug. And at that point in time, I didn't have a relationship with God. I didn't even know nothing about that. I got grandparents that are preachers or whatever. I didn't play the church thing. That wasn't my thing growing up. I did what I wanted to do, and I was proud of it. But I got a feeling of love so much from that night. And from that night, I was changed. I went back after the military, after our exercises. I stopped drinking. I stopped hanging out. People that I was going out with, I stopped associating with them. Just sort of like cold turkey. And I just felt. And in that point in my own, I knew that vulnerability kicked in for me. And I said, if people can realize that point of embracing their vulnerability, I think that's what took me over the threshold and where I got my power. I embraced those things that happened to me, and I put them in my arsenal to help me and to grow me. And from that point on, my journey had begun.
Your mom must be very proud of you.
Yes, she is. My mom's my number one cheerleader. She never knew a lot of what I went through. And as you can imagine, the mom and the sons, I was older son. We had a very close relationship. But after high school, our relationship kind of dropped off because I was going my way and my mom was church and she was going her way. And we didn't see eye to eye on a lot of things. And we stopped communicating about a lot of things. But she always prayed for me and she always felt that power of that God had me no matter that I didn't see it or not. She knew it. And we came back around, man, and now we have one of the greatest relationships that a mother and son could have. And I think the endurance of her prayers and me not willing to give up on who I truly was, I think that's what brought me to the point I am today.
Well, you see, one of the things I really admire about you, Carl, is the fact is that you mentioned vulnerability earlier. I mean, to speak about the torment that you went through, I wonder what you would have been if you hadn't had that torment. Forgive me for saying this, it's just that somehow in the midst of our struggles, we find our real self.
Yes.
Right?
And that's really the key, Jim. And that's really what I coach and consult on. And I work with the clients that I work with. I get them to see from a vantage point that they haven't all their entire life. And when we look at that point, we look at things that we've learned and we ideally look that way and say, oh, well, I learned this. I went to this school. This is the way I should be. Or I learned this. This is the way that I was raised. And this is some of the background. And we put all of our eggs in that basket. but we never look at the adversity of life that has carried us to those points and places. What was the learning piece about the failure that engrossed me to go and proceed and be successful? These are the things, and I don't count success as a dollar value. Mm-hmm. I don't count success as me obtaining so many material things. I count of success as a legacy I've left on someone, that path I've crossed that has changed the trajectory of their life. That's what I count success on. And I think putting it in that frame of mind, I don't have to be a billionaire to reach and change hearts. I don't have to be an influencer on TikTok to have people understand that their life means more than what it is.
Well, I really, what you're saying really resonates because in our world, I know you're a diversity, equity, inclusion consultant as well. Mm-hmm. But I listened to you and listened to how you you didn't just exist. I mean, you know, people that came from the same background that perhaps are still in the same background or our kids in the background. And you somehow managed to say, this is not good enough for me. Mm-hmm. Now, in some of my work with people, I've discovered that some people have a chip on their shoulder.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, people don't like me because I'm Black, because I'm Hispanic, because I'm short, because I'm too dark. I mean, I'm just wondering your insights about yourself, rather than trying to fix somebody else, mm-hmm. you fixed yourself.
That's the power we hold.
Yes.
Oftentimes we navigate that power to saying that, okay, we do it in relationships. Maybe I can fix him. Maybe I can fix her. We do it in partnerships and corporations. Maybe I could fix this team. Maybe I could fix this department. But in essence, the true fix comes within. And then once we fix ourselves, it permeates out where others see differences.
Yes.
What we fail to realize is that I'm going to fix what's wrong with someone else without me addressing what's wrong with me. And how can that be? I think the Bible says, and oftentimes I use the Bible in my quotes because it's true word to me. How can I get the beam? How can I get the speck or whatever out of your eye when I got a beam in mine?
Yes.
And the paraphrasing of it is, how can I address things that are wrong with you when I haven't addressed things that are wrong with me? And I think a lot of that, that's really what Malcolm was really getting at in the essence of that. King talked a lot about the self, the nonviolent piece of that. And engaging who you are and actually demonstrating on the outside. But I think Martin was the flip of that. How are we on the inside? How are we interacting with our own kind? How are we interacting with understanding who we truly are so we can treat each other better? And I think the conglomerate of both of them together came along with how I think, and I have followed them. And my thinking is that I can better people if I better myself because they get a better representation of who I am. So they can see a better representation of who they can be. And when we oftentimes, I say, and one of my best quotes is leadership needs an example. Leadership doesn't need the prototype that we've been shown for so many years. Yes. They need an example from somebody on the inside to permeate outside that this is what a leader should be. And now visually you can see it as, oh man, I can see that leader. But the characteristics, and I go to that again, Christ-like, came from his characteristics, not from how he looked. And if we be a leader, for example, they are come from our characteristics, not from how we look. So therefore, I can pattern my characteristics after someone who's white, someone who's Black, someone who's Asian, someone who's diverse, someone who's different than I am, because I see characteristics in them that I aspire to be.
Now, see, that's brilliant. You just hit on so much there that has to deal with our real character, because we go to work and we don't get along with other people, it could be a lot of reasons. It could be the fact that I'm wearing my pants down to my ankles, or I'm picking my teeth at lunchtime over the table or something. But it doesn't have to be because I'm Black. And if it is, maybe people just don't know it. When I was in the Navy, I met a guy from South Dakota, and this is many years ago. And I remember we're in Great Lakes. For training, and he said that I was the first Black person he'd ever seen. Okay, that was really interesting. I didn't have a problem with the man, but it's something that resonated me as a young man, that not everybody has the same life experiences, and because they don't, does not mean that I have to have a chip on my shoulder.
All right.
Okay, give people the benefit of the doubt, like you said earlier, be Christ-like. Ken Blanchard talks a lot about that, about being Christ-like and virtuous, mm-hmm. treating people, you know, let me tell you something real fast. I can't wait to talk to you about vulnerability in just a moment and teamwork.
Sure.
When I was in Boise, Idaho with my kids, who were real small at the time. I have three boys and a girl, and I remember taking everybody out with their white elephant gifts and going shopping at the mall. And so we get to the top of the mall from the food court area, and we're going to walk around. I have the boys. They want to be with me because I always spend more money than everybody else, okay? so they're with me, and I'm this diversity consultant, I think, okay? I think, all right? So I'm going to teach them some lessons because I look down and see this woman that has a clipboard in her hand, and all the other people had clipboards in their hands. They look up at us, this group of four people, and they don't pay us any attention. They just look at us and turn around and start speaking to the other people. Mm-hmm. And so I get closer and there's look at us again and they're still not paying us any attention. So I'm thinking, ha ha, I'm the expert here. I'm gonna teach them how they should respond to Black people. So I walk back up the area and I'm going to the manager's office way in the back in the mall, and I'm gonna give them a piece of my mind and tell them what's going on. So I get to my boys and I'm thinking I'm going to give them a life lesson how to deal with people and so on. I get there and before I get ready to knock on the door, I think maybe I should give her a break and go back and tell her what she did wrong so she can correct it. We walk all the way back, go back down the stairs. They're looking at us again. They don't say hello. They don't nod. They don't do anything. And I get down further with the boys and I'm thinking this is going to be a great life experience. But I get there, all of a sudden, I get ready to tap the lady on her shoulder. And I read her clipboard as she's talking to everybody else around her. And it says, Women's Breast Cancer Detection Center. It had nothing to do with me. Nothing to do with my race. Nothing whatsoever. Sure, men get breast cancer, but it wasn't anything to do with me. And I had jumped the gun and made it something that it was not entirely. And then I just walked away and explained it to my kids. So when I read what you were doing on vulnerability and teamwork, tell me about your work and some of the obstacles you encounter.
A lot of that, Jim, has come from lived experience. My very first post that I wrote, and I was not an online presence until the pandemic. And I think a lot of us have, as I've read some statistics, I think 200, the entrepreneurship has blossomed like 300% since January 2020. I'm part of that 300%. The work I've done has been things I've been talking about for over 30 years of being in leadership.
Yes.
I never think about being online presence. I did trainings, I did workshops and all that through the companies that employed me. Because it was a joy for me to do that. But I got into it from my very first job. I was at Lockheed Martin, getting out the military. I wanted to join Lockheed Martin. My aunt had been with them for years. Yes. About 40-some years, I think she eventually stayed with them. And she told me about a job that they was having there. And it was in the mailroom. And I just wanted to get to be a part of that because I knew coming from the military, Lockheed Martin was obvious. And this was in 91, I think. A great place to work, but I knew I was bigger than the military. And I knew from coming to the military, I was bigger than the mailroom. But I said, this would be an entry point to me because I'll show what I can prove. I just came from mm-hmm. military, blacks and whites. Didn't matter your rank. If you wasn't ranking the one above you, you had to listen and everybody fell in line. So I was not into how corporate leaderships, quote unquote, go. Like, you know, I didn't know about cliques. I didn't know about that because I didn't see it in the military. The military was my first formation of what a job in corporate leadership should be. So I brought that naivety, should I say now, to the table at Lockheed. And I said, I'm going to go in the mailroom and I'm going to watch everything and I'm going to absorb everything and they're going to see what kind of great employee I am. And eventually I'm going to go up the ladder. This was my thought process as a 22-year-old kid. And I said, I got to the mailroom and I met my supervisor. His name was Jeff. And Jeff had no inkling of me learning anything but me stamping mail, processing it, and putting it out. But Jeff had to go away one afternoon, and Jeff did these packages that only went up to the CFOs and CEOs and the big wigs. And I watched Jeff I've been there about 6 months at this point, and I watched Jeff for about 6 months. I got kind of like a photographic memory, and I took all in what he did to get these packages processed for this upper echelon. And one came in when he left for lunch, and I said, wow, this is my moment. This is my moment to show him because they haven't given me an opportunity and I'm going to take it now. Now, the naivety in me says, yo, go do that, man. You can make a name for yourself. The stupidity in me says, man, that's not your place. That's not your life. Yes. You could get fired, right? But yes, me not knowing that and me not disobeying a direct order because my mindset is still military charge. Yes. I say, oh yeah, I could do this and I can show him what I do. And I did it, and one of the bigwigs came in, and I didn't know who he was at the time. He came in for lunch, and he was looking for this package. Long story short, that package that he was looking for, I was actually doing the work for. So when he came back, he told me, he said, well, tell Jeff, Jim came by, and I'll see him later. So Jeff came in. I finished the package and got in and got it all ready. I said, yo, I did this, man, and I'm excited, just a naive kid excited. And he said, man, what do you do, man? I said, yeah, I watched you. I saw how I go. I did everything right. And I said, oh, by the way, Jim came by and he said he'll give you a call and check in with you later. So he said, Jim, he said, you know, Jim was, he's like, this is Jim package you did. So he's in uproar, you know, mm-hmm. needless to say. And I'm like, well, everything's done right. I know I've done it right. I watched you. And if you're doing it wrong, then what I've seen from you is the reason why, right? So he left it alone and all that. He's like, man, you shouldn't have done it. So he just gave me kind of like the riot act. So I was quiet the rest of the day. I got in and I kind of thought about that driving home. And as I got back to work the next day, I was in an apologetic mode because I kind of figured I had jacked up, right? He said Jim wanted to see me. That was his after good morning. That's what he told me. He's like, Jim, I want to see you upstairs. He's like, I have no idea what it's about, but he called for you this morning. So I was like, okay. So now at this point, it's all sinking in on me that Carl, maybe you overstepped. And, mm-hmm. you know, so I'm riding on the elevator up now. I'm in the mirror room. I'm riding on the elevator up. It's a long ride. They're at the top floor. And I'm like, oh, I can't tell you so many things are going through my mind at this point, right? I think I just, and most importantly, I'm thinking of my aunt because she's put it out on the neck. She's been here for the longest. And like, how's this going to do on her? And then, you know, to her, my mom and sisters, and how I'm thinking of that whole tantrum. I'm not even really thinking about what could happen to me. Yes. And I get up there, and then this is how you know you're in like a different world, like marble doors, like wood grain desks and office and receptionist with the little headset. It looks nothing like the mirror room. I can tell you that, right? It looks nothing like the mirror room. I'm like, yo, like, is this the same building? I'm like, this can't be the same building I'm in. It's like, this looks like a royal palace. So I get in and I say, I'm here to see Jim. And I said, and she said, yes, he's expecting you. Have a seat and I'll let him know you're here. So she calls back and he says, sit him down. So she tells me to go down this hallway and his office is the last one on the left. So I go in the hallway. It's like a museum of presidents, all white, like dignity. I guess they're like the heads of whatever this is, mm-hmm. You know, the top. And I'm like, yo, I don't see anybody looks like me. So I'm getting more feel for it at the moment. So I get to his door and I knock on the door, Jim. And it's like, his name is Jim as well. And I knock on the door and he said, come on in, have a seat. And he was kind of stern, an older white gentleman, you know, and he had been around for a while and you could tell he was an older white guy. And he said, yeah, I heard you done a package or something yesterday. And that wasn't what you was assigned to do. And I was like, yes. I said, I did the package. And I said, well, let me explain. I said, so I can kind of get an explanation out of why I did that. I said, I've been there 6 months. I watched everything they did. And they gave me nothing but opening mail and sorting out mail. I said, I'm a thinker. My mind goes. I said, I'm really like trapped down there. And I said, I just wanted to do something to show them that they have more down there than what they realize. And he kind of grinned at me and he sat down because he didn't sit down when I was talking. I sat down, but he didn't sit down. And I was like nervous. I was nervous at that.
Bad sign.
Yeah, because it was kind of like, it was kind of like a hem up like principal kind of thing. I'm in the principal office. And he said, you know what? He said, the package you was doing was for me. And he said, I want to tell you, you've done a great job because everything on it was right. Posters and everything was right on it. He said, I just had an issue with you doing it. And I said, oh, okay, here's the thing, right? He said, but the caveat is it, he said, you remind me of me. And now I'm like befuddled because I'm like, here's this young black kid. And like, you're this established white guy who's, yes. been, you know, how are we even on the same plane? And he said, you remind me of me. He said, because when I started in this company, I think it was 36 years at that point. When I started in this company over 30 some years ago, he said, I started in the mailroom. And he said, I was a think tank guy. And he said, they trapped me in that mailroom for 2.5 years. And he said, I didn't take the process like you did. He said, you took a chance on yourself. And he said, maybe I befuddled my 2.5 years there and just did the work and followed the process. But he said, you took a chance. And he said, that's what prompted me to call you up here. He said, I saw you and me, but I didn't take the chance and you did. He said, that's where you and I differ. He said, you took that chance, Carl. And he said, I'm going to take a chance on you. So at this point, I'm like, okay, take a chance on me. What's next? He said, how do you like about Think Tank? I said, Think Tank. I said, man, that's my thing. I said, I love. I said, I come up with ideas. I come up with process. I come up with vision. I said, I'm not doing good on the logistics. I don't know how we'll put it together, but I see stuff like that. He said, good. He said, I got seven white guys that work in the Think Tank that I'm over. He was the CEO of the Think Tank department for the Tomahawk cruise missile for Lockheed Martin in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'm going to put you in the Think Tank with these guys. He said, you don't look like them. You don't think like them. But he said, that's going to be your power. And he said, go in there and just do everything that you know to do. He said, don't worry about their smart talk. Don't worry about what they call you. Don't worry about it. He said, take it all in, embrace it all in and learn. And I said, oh, he said, start Monday. This was Monday when I came back to work. He said, you start next Monday. He said, you go down to the mailroom, close out all the stuff you're doing, report back up here Monday, and I'm going to start your neck. And he said, this is the beginning of your future. And he said, because you did something that I didn't do, he said, I'm going to do something that nobody done for me. He said, I'm going to put you in a place where you can grow. I stayed there 6 years, man. And that gave me the insight of being vulnerable, embracing who you truly are, regardless of whatever the environment. Because you're either going to win or you're going to lose. And I want to win and lose with me rolling the dice. I don't want to win and lose with anyone else having control of the outcome. And if I fail at that, there's always lessons in failure. I want to be the one that's in the charge of that. And that's what he put me in. So that really embraced me on this vulnerability tick, man. So I always explain that to my CEO counterpart. So I talk to them about taking chances. You never know who you have, that person that's sitting there that you've noticed and you've seen that they do things differently, but you haven't come out of your stubbornness to say, you know what? I'm going to take a chance on you. I'm going to put you in places that you haven't been before, and I'm going to see how you shine. And these are the opportunities that diversity is looking for. And when I encompass that, I encompass the female, I encompass the African-American, I encompass the Asian, I encompass those who bring the value of work from an essence that white Anglo-Saxons have not seen. And that's really the truth of the matter.
I am impressed, my friend. That is one of the best life stories as well as professional I've heard in a long time. I admire how you didn't stay put ever. You didn't say, well, I was born this way in this neighborhood. This is where I'm going to die like this. You said, you didn't. Let me ask one more question on that, by the way. Yeah. Who was your role model, aside from your mom, that said, this is not good enough?
I had an uncle, my uncle Aaron. He lives, retired police. He was a Chicago police. And he's retired now in Florida. And my uncle used to come and get me after my dad died. My dad died when I was 15, so I really have a father figure. I was raised by grandma, aunts, and my mom. And that's why I get the real strength in the vulnerability piece. Because from 15 to 20, in that range, women poured into me. Mm-hmm. And they poured into me a different mindset. Not they didn't take, because my dad had built up the man mm-hmm. before he died. He had built up what it was to work, what it was to be hard, what it was to be coarse, what it was to be a man, take care of bills, take care of your household. He had poured that into me. But what I got from the women's point of that was how there are more than one ways to skin a cat, how you don't have to always stand on this stance to get things done, how the negotiation piece is a prime example of how we get things done. They taught me all of those ins and outs, the social pieces of that, how to articulate conversations wise where you don't have to take a stand and die, how you can articulate a conversation to say both of us win. They taught me that piece of it. And in that part, I got to know how I can deal and navigate life without this being the end, without this being my way or the highway. And my uncle was a big piece of that. When he came and picked me up, he said, since your dad is gone, he said, I know you have another man. My dad has six brothers, but my uncle Aaron was the only one that took this on. At the funeral, they all told me they'll be there for me. And they'll come by and they'll check on me and my brother at the time. And they said, we'll make sure that you guys have all you need or whatever. Needless to say, they wasn't there. My one uncle Aaron said, you know what? I'm going to pick up this man on carrot because him and my dad were close. He took me to museums in Chicago. He came every Saturday. We went to someplace nostalgic, someplace cultural, someplace meaningful in Chicago. We went downtown. We went to the art museums. We went to see Picasso's. We went to the Shedd Aquarium. We learned about fish, whales, sharks. We went to the art museum. We learned about art, Picasso, and all of those kind of Da Vinci, all of those things. He took me to the Black History Museums. We learned about Tubman. We learned all of every Saturday for the past, for that last year of high school, we went and we culturalized Chicago and what it offered. Beside that little neighborhood where I grew up at, where it was a liquor store in the corner where everybody hung out with their 40 ounces and where drugs and gangs were being sold. And that let me see that everything I always envisioned was out there. I just had to go get it. I was the only one stopping me. And he gave me that clarity.
But you did it, my friend.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, you know, darn. I mean, you did it. I mean, you stepped out of the shoes and said, I'm going to get some new shoes. I'm going to do something different. But your uncle came along and made himself a mentor.
Yes, he did. He was my very first mentor. And that's what I do now. I mentor at the university I graduated from. I mentor young law professors there. They're seeking minority law students. They're seeking to go to law school. And I give them advice on which direction to take, what schools would be applicable to them, how they can grow and not necessarily going to the Duke and the Harvards, but going to those schools that are benefit them as the small niche schools. Because you're going to schools for the education. And what we fail to realize, yes, names are great. I mean, if you're wearing polo clothes or Gucci clothes, it's great if you can afford them. But I tell you what, my Lees and Levi's, they fit just as good. And they get the job done.
Yes.
And this is what we have to teach our kids. If you go to a college and apply yourself 100% based upon the curricula they have, you'll be successful. It doesn't matter if the college is St. John Newman's or if it's Duke University. When you go there and apply yourself, this is where the difference is made. And that's what I've taught my kids. I have two adult kids, and one is going for a master's, and one is getting ready to graduate with his CPA. And I tell them, it doesn't matter the name on an institution. It's how you apply yourself at that institution. And if you get involved, and you be social, and you be active, and you understand, and you educate, articulate, all of those things will bear you great fruits when you come from there. So this is where it was. And that's how my uncle taught me. He's like, you know, it doesn't matter where you go. He said, you take you with you wherever you go. So he said, if you improve you, you grow you, wherever you take you, you'll be a better you. And he said that so many times to me, I can repeat it as I can hear him saying it in the back of my head, because it's truth. It's truth in that, Jim.
Well, I think Benjamin Franklin attended Yale University, and he was kicked out because he was a drunkard. Did you know
that? Yes.
So he could have used your advice.
Yes.
So let me ask you a question. I hope we're able to do some work together one of these days. Absolutely, because man, I love your insights. And I also like the fact is that you are grounded. You understand where you've been and with the changes you can make in your life. And what a role model. I didn't have any male role models in my life at all. Everyone that taught me anything were all women. Mm-hmm. You know, period. So I don't know what that's like, you know, but I have a question. Here's my question. So if you could have dinner this evening with three people, living or dead, who would they be?
My three mentors, and though they don't even know me, I've gained a lot from them. King, Malcolm, and Obama.
Oh, good choices.
I would have all three of them, because I think through the lineage of who we are as African-American men, they all live.
Yes.
And through the heritage of which they've all carried, we can all understand. And when I say that, sitting in their presence and getting a conversation with them, asking them some of those questions that maybe they was answered in, maybe they were asked, I'm sorry, and had not able to be expound on, or maybe they was asked and they were shortcut and they didn't really give the true essence of what their answer should be. Yes. I think sitting in that as us as a quartet, and me being able to articulately ask the questions of them, where do you see us at now? And I really would want all three of their versions of that. And when I say that, I mean as a society, and I don't even really mean it as black and white. I just mean it as everything that they fought for and the prestigious elevations that they've attained, even with Obama being the president. Looking back on where we are now as a society, as a country, as a nation, where have we gone? Where do you think we've went wrong? That's what I really would like to know from them. And I would like to wholeheartedly hear that, based upon what they have seen. And even though Malcolm and Martin are dead and gone, I do think with just them visualizing where we are now as a society, they're disappointed.
Yes.
To say the least. And I would want to hear that for our youth that are coming up, because I do think they're on the horizon. And I do think greater things are in the essence of befalling us as far as our youth. They aren't your grandparents' grandparents. Mm-hmm. These young guys that are coming up, I'm involved with quite a few now, and their mindset of taking things to greater levels, but they need us as ambassadors. We can't drop the pendulum yet. Yes. Us that have been in the trenches, because they haven't been. They haven't mm-hmm. been in any fights. They haven't been in any foxholes. They haven't been in those wars. They're seeing it from the glamorized of social media and how they can make it. But if we stay the ambassadors and pass on the wisdom and doctrine to them, I think we could be in a better place, Jim.
I agree. So we are, in fact, our brother's keeper.
Absolutely. I do. I believe that to the core.
Yes, indeed. I know you do, my friend. I am so glad to have you on. I hope you have you on another time.
Yes.
You know what? I could talk to you forever. I bet you'd be fun to go to the Grand Canyon too on a road trip.
Oh man, you put me in the RV, man. I said when I retire, I told my wife that she's not really the fly lady. She love to fly. Put her on an airplane, she's ready to go. You're talking about driving anywhere. She's not for them long rides, right? I said when we retire, so I'm gonna treat you to a big RV and we just gonna ride cross country. She's like, I'll meet you there.
Sounds like my wife.
She's so like, listen, I'm not with that ride. She's like, I'll meet you at the airport.
Hey, do me a favor, Carl, and yes, give your wife my best.
I will, Jim. Thank
because
you.
Because she's helping create a person like you that's giving back to many people.
Bless
and
you,
so Michael. Please tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you.
Yes, go as Jim has so eloquently put and stalk my website, carlshawnwatkins.com. It is definitely everything on there, from individual growth to leadership, to CEO, C-suite, teams, management, leaders. I cover them all just from the premise of emphasis on vulnerability and leadership. If we can be vulnerable with one another, we'll see how good we match and parallel with each other. So go check me out. Also check me out on LinkedIn, Carl Shawn Watkins and Carl Shawn Watkins Consultant, my LinkedIn business page. I'm always there. That's where I curate the most of my content. And that's where you can come as well. And join me also. I got want to tell people this. I am doing a business recession proof webinar September the 24th, doing it on Zoom. It's called Next Level Business Moves. Go to my website for that. The landing page, nextbusinessmoves.com. Register by September 9th. It's going to be an hour packed of just great information for you, from you to recession-proof your business from a standpoint of growing. So go check me out on that. Thanks, Jim. I appreciate you, man, for having me on. It has been an honor, a privilege, and I am definitely humbled to continue to work with you and any other person that wants to see how DEI can be more effective in your organization.
Well, Carl can actually help your organization. And I know he can, because one thing I do like about him is that he's relatable. It doesn't matter what your message is. You have to have someone to be able to get the message out to people in a yes. way that they can understand it and apply it.
Yes.
So to our listeners, thank you very much for supporting this podcast, and to Carl Shawn Watkins and his family and the people who guided him. I imagine a lot of them were unseen, his dad and many others that moved yes. him forward. Thank you so much. We can all make a difference out there. Let's do it together. Take care, my friend.
Thank you, Jim. Have a great one, man. Awesome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.